Blog Talk Radio.
Whoa, no music. Not sure what happened there. Can you guys hear me? Yeah. All right, so this is your On Book Show. No intro music for some reason today. Not sure what's happened exactly, but that's fine. We'll get right into it. Today I answer your questions. This is an opportunity for you to call in, ask any question you would like on any topic you would like. I actually don't promise to answer every question you ask. There might be some questions I'm going to have to defer and not answer. But you can ask them. you can call 347-324-3075, 347-324-3075. And you have to press 1, I think, after you call so that a question mark appears on my screen so that I know that you want to ask a question. Now, because some people call just to listen into the show and I get their numbers on my screen as well, to know you're actually asking a question, you have to press 1. Now, I have I asked for questions to be submitted in advance, so I have tons of questions. I categorize them kind of by topic, foreign policy, culture, diet. I got 3 questions on diet. These are my favorite, gender and sex. So we're going to have to get to the gender and sex questions because I always complain that Dr. Peacock gets all the sex questions and then I get boring economic and other questions, political questions. So this is my opportunity to cover some questions about sex. By the way, if you're listening online and you want to ask a question about sex, 347-324-3075. As I said, I might not answer it, but you can certainly ask it. We got questions on politics. We got questions on aesthetics, on art. We got questions in economics, on Ayn Rand, on people's personal questions about their personal life, on history, about AI, about immigration, and just miscellaneous questions. So a wide variety of questions that I already have. And then, of course, we're gonna have questions from you live. So, this should be fun. So some of these questions that were sent in, are kind of lengthy. I didn't get anything. I have to thank anybody because I have to thank you guys. I didn't get any questions, deep philosophy that I cannot answer. Like no questions on epistemology, no questions on metaphysics. I just have to say thank you because I would probably flunk those. So you guys ask questions that I think for the most part I can answer. Some of them require long answers and I might skip some of those or save them for a future show. Some of them can be quick and snappy and we can do quickly. Like this one. Do you think video games are a good hobby to have? I mean, why not? Why would video games not be a good hobby to have? You know, as long as, like every hobby, they don't become obsessive. They don't take you away from your productive function in life. They don't distract you from that productive function. They don't take you away from relationships and family. And I mean, the bottom line is they don't become obsessive. I think video games is danger. And this is why I don't play them, is that I would become obsessed. I'd want to play them all day. I dream about video games. When I close my eyes, all I would see are video games, and they would just dominate. I just know myself. They would dominate my consciousness, and it would become a massive distraction from my productive endeavor and from my ability to have relationships with other people. When I was young, I think in high school and then when I was in the Israeli army and then a little bit after that and then a little bit later, like in my 40s, I used to play bridge. I don't know how many of you play bridge. I think that the most fun of all card games. And I did. I even played competitively a little bit in Israel when I was growing up. And I got obsessed by it. I mean, literally, I used to close my eyes and I would see cards. And I used to dream about bridge. And all I could think about, I think I didn't do well a whole year in math because all I could think about was all I could think about is bridge. So my point is this: if you can control it. If this is, I think a video game strike me as something that could be incredibly fun. And if it, particularly if they're challenging and they're intellectual challenging, which I think some video games are, but they can also be just fun, like blow up the bad guys and shoot them. It could be a great way to, let out some steam. I have a lot of that steam after I watch debates, political debates, or I think about foreign policy. I want to go blow up some bad guys. So, that's a great way to let out that steam is play video games, just as long as you control that. And by the way, on the chat here, please don't compare me to your grandparents. I mean, I'm old, but I'm not that old. I don't think I could be anybody's grandparent who is online right now, I think. Actually, that's not true. I'm quickly doing the math, and actually, there are a few of you who I probably could be your grandparent, but I mean, mathematically speaking or biologically speaking, but not in practice. Okay. So that was an easy one, right? Video games. Okay. Let's take a phone call and then we'll take on some more of the serious, although video games are serious. I mean, don't feel guilty about playing video games if you're controlling it, if you're in charge and you're not obsessing and it isn't dominating your life and it's not taking away from your productive endeavors and it's not taking away from relationships. All right, let's take our first question on the phone. Hi, you're on the Yaron Brooks Show. Who's this?
Hey, this is Corey from Minnesota. Yaron, how are you?
I'm good. How about you?
Not too bad. Hey, I got a quick question for you here.
So just for fun, what's the temperature in Minnesota right now?
It is actually, I think it's supposed to be up in the 40s right now. It's like 37, 38. Oh, no. It's actually not too bad.
Okay.
Yeah.
This is a real warm day, real warm day in Minnesota. It's like 78 degrees and sunny in Southern California. Just as an explanation for why we pay the high taxes. Go ahead, Corey.
Yeah, right. So you go all over the world, basically, and speak at colleges and stuff. And I've always wondered, do you think that your message is getting through? I mean, how confident are you that you're getting through to the kids?
Oh, you're starting us off on a depressing question, huh?
It's something I wonder about.
Yeah, so I'm pretty confident that I'm getting through to some of the kids. The question is always how many, and I don't know the answer to that. And I fear that the answer to that could be somewhat depressing. It's probably not many, but I'm getting through to some, and I know that because they write to me, they tell me years later that maybe a talk of mine changed their lives, and it's all over the world, so I know I'm getting through to people all over the world because I hear from them all over the world, and in some countries there seems to be more receptivity than others, and some of my talks I can walk away and say, yeah, I really felt like the audience really got it, and some kids really, the light switched on for them at some point or another, whereas in other places, I get a feeling, oh, that was a waste of time. But so I couldn't do it if my sense was it's having no impact. So if there are any of you out there who went to a talk of mine and it had an impact and I got through to you, In a way that nothing had beforehand, let me know. You can write to ARI Radio at iCloud.com, ARI Radio at iCloud.com, because it's very inspiring to me to hear from you that it had that effect, and it helps keep me going. The fact is, it helps keep me going. So,
well, I can say for myself, if you don't mind me interrupting, I got turned on to you by friends, and I listened to your lectures on YouTube, The Morality of Capitalism, and that really made everything kind of click for me. It was like some ways I kind of always felt this way, but I didn't really know that I felt that way until I started listening to you guys, to you.
So did you listen to that before you read Ayn Rand?
Yes. Yep.
Okay. Cool.
And that made me want to read her, and now I'm halfway through Atlas Shrugged, and you know, I have other things, you know, on my Nook. And by the way, I did pre-order Equals Unfair.
Thank you.
I'll let you know that on Twitter. Yep.
As all of you out there should be doing, pre-ordering Equal is Unfair on Amazon or anywhere else. But look, Corey, I think it's thousands of people have been impacting by what I specifically have done in terms of the lectures I've given. I hope it's thousands of people. And because for every person I hear from, I assume that there are dozens of people I haven't heard from. And you got to do it. I mean, I don't know an alternative. I don't know any other way to get to people. Now, books matter, obviously. So you write books as well. Ayn Rand's books matter. So we try to get as many teachers to teach Ayn Rand's novels as possible. So you have to hit it on all cylinders, on all fronts. You have to go at it in a variety of different ways. Different people are going to be attracted to these ideas because of different things. Changing the world is a slow, lengthy process. If I thought that this could be done quickly, I'd be incredibly frustrated.
Right. And one last question, and then I'll get out of your way. Right. You've been on Fox News a couple of times. Yep. Have you ever been asked to host a show on TV? And if so, would you?
No, I've never been asked to host a show on TV. I've never been asked to host a show on radio. And I would do either one of them in a heartbeat. I mean, don't tell people, but though here I am telling everybody. Yeah, I mean, I would love to host a show on TV. I don't know that I would move full-time to New York to do it. So hopefully they would be willing to do something from Southern California. But I would actually be more excited about a radio show. I think my talents are better for radio. TV is more a medium for interviews. I don't know that I'm that good of an interviewer. I'm too impatient. I'm not really that interested in what people have to say. I want to talk.
Yeah.
You know, it's my ideas that I want to get out there. Yeah, and so I like radio. Radio gives me, like on this show, I get the opportunity to just talk for an hour and a half, and then I do the show in Chicago, which is another hour. So I get to talk for 2.5 hours. Right. Hopefully you guys are entertained and enjoy it, but I certainly entertain myself and enjoy it. So if somebody came to me tomorrow and said, Yaron, how would you like a nationally syndicated 3-hour-a-day radio show, you know, replace Rush Limbaugh or somebody like that, I would take it in a heartbeat. Even if it wasn't syndicated yet or somebody thought they could get it syndicated and they would work at doing that, I would take it. My long-term goal for my retirement, if you will, when I leave the Institute, would be to do exactly that. It would be to have a daily show on radio and just do that every day. Now, and that's incredible amount of work, because to do it daily would require a huge amount of work and a huge amount of research every day. And I mean, I have huge amounts of respect for people like Rush Limbaugh. I don't agree with Rush Limbaugh. I can't stand him in many ways, but huge amount of respect for the ability to do what he does 3 hours every single day and the amount of work that takes. Anyway, that's my dream job for one day when I stop doing what I'm doing at the Institute.
Awesome. Well, that's great.
If you know anybody and can get me that job, then go for it.
Okay, well, I'll see what I can do, sir.
There you go. Thanks, Corey. And
if
you have more questions, then maybe keep listening. And if there's a lull in the program, feel free to chime back in.
Awesome. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. All right. Let's take another question here. Let's see. Let's take one from that's about... the culture that has to do with changing the culture. So this is one. It says, I've heard you say, me say, in Q&As at some university, that you think we have about 20 years to change the culture to the right ideas. if I understand you correctly, in what facts do you support that? So where does the 20 years come from? So let me say what I mean by that first. What do I mean by 20 years to change the culture? It's not that I think that in 20 years we can change the culture. And I think that we have 20 years to start the process. That is, we have 20 years to see the beginnings of change. We have 20 years to change the direction of the culture so that 20, 40, 60 years after that, it actually is changed. Now, why do I think that? And where do I get the 20 years? I get the 20 years. I pull it out of the air. I don't know if it's 20 years. I don't know how to put a number on this. 20 years sounds good because it's about as long as my career is going to last, right? I will turn, I think we should have a drum roll for this. I will turn 55 later this year, right? 55. I am actually getting pretty old, which is kind of scary. Anyway, so figure I got 20 years to keep doing this because I've got energy and I'm healthy and I can see doing this kind of stuff for about until about 75 years. So if 20 years is a good number. It's also about one generation, right? So 20 years is just a good number in terms of that. And look, I also see the decline in education. I see what Dr. Peikoff wrote in DIM in terms of the changes that are happening in the culture, although I fear that those changes, because of technology, might be happening even faster than what he predicts in DIM. I mean, what Peikoff predicts in DIM, DIM is the DIM hypothesis, his book, which I recommend to everybody, and you should, not as a first book in objectivism, but after you've really studied a lot of ideas for a while, DIM is a great book to read. In DIM, he talks about 40 years. But in 40 years, he says, if nothing dramatically changes, if we continue on the path we're on, he predicts in 40 years we'll have a kind of dictatorship, an authoritarian regime in the United States. And he predicts it would be a type of religious authoritarianism, what he calls an M2. But I'm not going to get into that. And I kind of agree with that, or I do agree with that, although I think it might happen quicker because of technology. But so at some point, that becomes inevitable in the sense that it's very hard to change a certain path that a culture is on. I don't think it is inevitable right now. So if you take 40 years, I take half of that. My view is we've got half of it to bring about change. If we don't bring about the change in the next 20 years, change in direction, change in focus, just change in drift, don't bring about it in 20 years, then that 40 years prediction becomes inevitable. So that's where I get 20 years. You know, there is no number. There is no right number, right? My view is this. You got to do everything you can today to change the fundamental philosophical views in the culture. Otherwise, all is lost. And it's about philosophy. And this is where people talk about long-term versus short-term. There is no conflict between the two. The only way to change a culture, where it's sustainable over the long term, argue for different, better philosophical ideas. So the only way to change the culture we have today is to fight altruism, to fight collectivism, to fight statism. And the only way to do that is to fight for reason, for rational self-interest, and for capitalism, for individual rights and capitalism. So that is the only way to change the culture, to fight right now as much as you can. And in that sense, you can help in lots of different ways, by speaking up, by fighting yourself, by writing, by speaking, by just talking to your friends about better ideas, but also by buying Ayn Rand, handing the books out to friends, pre-ordering Equal is Unfair, buying Free Market Revolution, my previous book, buying Ayn Rand's books, and sending a contribution to the Ayn Rand Institute, which all of you should be doing. All right. Okay, let's go to the phones and take one more call, and then we'll get back to some of these questions. Actually, let me take one quick question here, and then we'll take the call. Are social justice warriors evil or just misguided? Actually, this is not a quick question. But anyway, they could be either one of them. Social justice warriors, these people who go around and harass people for having politically incorrect views and are standing up for the so-called fairness and so-called leftist justice, many of them are evil. Many of them are evil in the sense that they are evaders who are out to destroy more than they are out to pursue any positive values. They are out to tear down. And they're not pursuing anything positive. They're not trying to build anything. They're not trying to make anything. So many of them are evil. Many of them know or at least have evaded the truth and are motivated by emotion rather than reason. And by the nihilists. Many of them are indeed nihilists. But I am sure that a lot of them are just misguided. They're young. They've been caught up with their friends in some political, philosophical agenda. They've never been exposed to better ideas. And they just don't know anything better. And they're following the leader. We might even call some of them immoral, but evil. Evil is we leave that for the real nihilists, right? The real nihilists, the real evaders, the real destroyers. Now, and many of them are that, but there are some that are innocent and misguided. You have to evaluate. You can get into conversation with them and pretty quickly tell whether there's any point in continuing the conversation. Also depends on how old they are. The younger they are, the more I would argue for misguided. The older they are, if they're Noam Chomsky's age, they are pure evil. So to sustain the justice warrior mentality into old age is pure evil. Noam Chomsky is a good example of how evil these bastards can be. All right, let's try on a question over the phone. Hi, you're on the Iran Book Show. Who's this?
Hello?
Hi, yes.
Oh, hello, Dr. Brooke.
Hey.
This is Muhammad Ali from the University of Rochester, New York.
All right. Another cold place. How's it going?
Very, very cold, yeah. I'm trying to build, actually, a club for objectivism up in my university. It's very bureaucratic, actually, the school, and there's a lot of formality in it. So a way we could stick out to... Michael, we can stick out so we can actually get approved is actually to host events. And actually, we're trying to ask Don Watkins to come here around April. And we'd be really happy to have you next year, too, because I heard this year you're kind of busy. So, I mean,
yeah,
we could set up.
We'd love to do it. I would love to come. Rochester's a bit in the middle of nowhere, but on some trip to the East Coast, I would love to do it. So stay in touch with the people who run our student clubs, and
yes,
hopefully Don will come in April, and hopefully I'll come sometime in the fall or in the spring.
I'd love to have you, Dr. Brooke. I mean, that would be pretty awesome.
Good.
I mean, I can ask questions in person. And by the way, income inequality is a big deal here, very big.
Big deal everywhere.
I know, but I mean, I come from a fairly liberal school, and it was not that big a deal here. It's actually, I come from a fairly low-income place, but the University of Rochester is a very high-income place, and here they care more about wealth distribution than kids that I knew, low-income, and that's kind of unique to me.
It's a middle-class and upper-class issue. This is not an issue primarily of the working class. Most healthy working-class Americans want to do well, and they want their kids to do really well, so they don't resent success. It's really the guilt-driven intellectuals in upper classes who are the ones who drive the whole inequality debate, not the lower-income people.
Honestly, I came here with a friend of mine from the same – I came to this university with a friend of mine who
yep.
recommended it to me from the same area, and he's also getting into objectivism. He likes it.
Excellent.
He would also love to have you here.
Excellent. Well, we'd love to come.
And – You know, and both of us honestly don't care that we, you know, that we weren't born with the so-called privileges some other folks have. You know, honestly,
good.
I'm here to be an engineer. He's here to be a mathematician,
good.
And that's all.
Absolutely.
We,
you got to live your
second,
life and
yes.
You know, ignore this nonsense of privilege and so on. You make the most of your life. That's what this philosophy is about. It's about living your life to the max and keep doing that. So good. I'm looking forward to meeting you sometime in Rochester. I love coming on campuses and speaking to students. So
Is there some way I could email you for next year? I know again, this year you're fairly busy. Is there
yeah,
one
I mean,
way
the best
I could...
thing is to do it through our campus club, people at the Institute,
okay.
The Ayn Rand Institute. You can also email me at airyradio@icloud.com.
Okay.
I definitely get that email.
Okay. Just one other quick question.
Sure.
Have you ever read any books by Peter Thiel? Have you ever heard of Peter Thiel?
I have not read the books. I know Peter. I've met Peter a couple of times, been at his house, and have skimmed the books, but haven't read them in detail. Why are you asking?
He's one of his entrepreneurs. I'm actually doing the engineering for entrepreneurship, but he has the wrong idea of what Ayn Rand says. I mean, in the book, the last page, he kind of has an idea that, you know, she's against collaboration, and, you know, that's pretty important
in
a startup.
It's so common. It's so common that view, which is complete nonsense, and it's sad that somebody like Peter Thiel, who's very smart, would argue that Ayn Rand is against collaboration. Let me be very clear. She is not against collaboration. Ayn Rand believes in collaboration. She believes in the immense value of collaboration. But collaboration as trade, not a sacrifice. And she would argue that you know, absolutely collaboration is a virtue between productive human beings who are collaborating on something worthwhile and creating value. So she believed in the incredible value of society. There is actually a blog post that addresses this that I recommend to you and to everybody else. Let me just see if I can find it. Why isn't it up here? Anyway, it's called Check Your Premises. It's a website, a blog, Check Your Premises. And he just Ben Baer, who runs the blog, just put up a blog addressing exactly this issue of collaboration. So I encourage you to read that.
Yes, I will.
And
thank you very much.
Sure, thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Brook. Thank you. Bye-bye.
And I look forward to meeting you sometime in Rochester. Maybe, you know what, you should come to OCON. You can probably get a student scholarship to OCON, come for free to OCON. So that would be great. So maybe I'll meet you in Washington. You won't have to wait for me to come to Rochester. Okay, let's take some other questions. Diet. Here's a diet question. What the hell, right? Should nutrition be a component of objectivism? What is objectivism? Objectivism is a philosophy. A philosophy. It is metaphysics, epistemology, ethics, politics, aesthetics. That's what objectivism covers. What is nutrition? Nutrition, at best, is a science. It's a science about what one should eat, what is good for you and what's not good for you. Science doesn't belong within objectivism. Science is science. Would you say, is physics a component of objectivism? No. I mean, you can use objectivist principles and apply them to physics, right? In a sense that you want to be rational and objective and the senses and, you know, the epistemology. But you wouldn't say that physics is a branch or component of objectivism. Physics is a separate science. Any more than you would say economics is a component of objectivism. Economics is not. Even free market economics is not a part of objectivism. It's a science. It's consistent with objectivism, and proper nutrition would be consistent with objectivism. What does objectivism say about nutrition? Don't eat poison. Context, in the full context of your life, eat the best that you can eat for you that will make your life the best that it can be. There might be eat in a way that allows you to live the longest you could be. But if you have to give up, for example, something that gives you immense pleasure, then it's not clear that length is the primary, right? And it depends on how much eating that thing that gives you immense pleasure will shorten your life. So nutrition is not a component of objectivism. There is a true science of nutrition somewhere. I don't think it's been discovered yet. I don't think we know enough to be able to say what good nutrition is yet. It is your responsibility as an objectivist to do what's good for your life. So do, you know, try to discover the best principles of nutrition as they apply to your life and to your values. That's all you can say about this, all right? Okay, let's do a couple of gender and sex questions. And I'm going to get into trouble, and some of you are going to be really pissed off at me. But, you know, as Donald Trump would say, tough. I can't believe I just quoted Donald Trump. Anyway, so here's one that's kind of tricky. Do you think, well, it's not tricky at all, actually. So this is why I think you'll get pissed off at me, because I don't think this is tricky at all. Do you think gender is determined by your biology or by society? I mean, really? Of course it's determined by your biology, right? Do you have a penis or do you have a vagina? Do you have a womb or don't you have a womb? Breasts? No breasts. And then, of course, your hormones, your hormonal composition. So your gender is determined unequivocally by your biology, by your nature. Look in the mirror if you can't figure it out. Now, there are tragic cases where biology sends mixed signals. That is, it might even biologically give you different sex organs. And that's confusing and not good. It's complicated, right? But that's not typical. That's very, very rare. Now, it could also be that biology confuses you in terms of hormones. You might be a man physically, but get more feminine hormones. Now, I don't know enough to say what kind of, do not know enough to say what kind of impact that has. So I don't know how confused one could be because of one's hormonal imbalances. Not an expert, don't know. But at the end of the day, your gender is determined by your biology. Now, you could grow up with a certain psychology that makes you think or makes you want to be a different gender. I don't know. I mean, to me, that would be very sad. That would not be a good thing. It would not be a good thing to be born a male and want to be, as an adult, want to be a female. Or the other way around, be born a female and want to be a male. That would be sad. And this is connection to my second question I have here on the gender list. What do you think about high suicide rates among transsexuals? I would say I'm not surprised. And I'm not surprised because it must be unbelievably confusing and frustrating and conflicting. You're living a contradiction. And contradictions, it's not psychologically healthy to live a contradiction. That is, you're biologically determined to be one sex and psychologically you want to be a different sex. That is a real problem. So I'm not surprised that creates real existential angst, it creates real frustration. And also, you know, there's also the issue of discrimination. Transsexuals are discriminated against, and people ridicule them, and people make fun of them. So that's part of why the high suicide rate. But I think partially is it's this internal conflict. It's a contradiction. Because in my view, your gender is biologically determined. And then you might have a psychology that tells you you want to be something else, but then you're living a contradiction. You're living a conflict, and that is problematic. Now, I don't think that's the same as sexual orientation, although I'm not going to get into that, because I don't think it's the same. A sexual orientation, you're not denying your gender. You're just sexually attracted to the same gender if you're homosexual. So I think it's different. You're not denying the gender. Anyway, hopefully that got me into some hot water out there. And feel free to call up and ask follow up questions on that. Let's take a phone question and then we'll come back to some questions on politics, and then we'll leave the sex questions a little later. Hi, you're on the Wrong Book Show. Who's this?
Hi, Yaron. This is Dave from New York.
Hey, Dave. How's it going?
Good. First of all, I'd just like to say I learned so much more from your YouTube videos than I ever did in college. Ever.
Well, thank you.
So thank you for that.
That's great.
And I just wanted to ask.
I mean, by the way, that says a lot about college, more than about my videos. But anyway.
But I wanted to ask you, how do people go through life without being exposed to objectivism? I mean, before I got into objectivism, totally neurotic and anxious and pissed off because nothing made sense. I was told contradictions constantly. And once I found objectivism is when I really started being a happier, more, rational human being. And most people had never heard of, read
so
objectivism.
So at what age did you discover objectivism?
I was 15, 16.
Okay, so young like me. Okay. Most people either not exposed to it or have heard of Ayn Rand but don't take it seriously enough to actually study it, or have read it and just dismiss it for some bizarre reason. I don't know how you can dismiss Ayn Rand's ideas. It was impossible, obviously, for me. I don't know. And think about it this way. People have existed without objectivism for millennia, right? Because she's new. So the human race has survived okay. Not great, but okay. Without Ayn Rand. So I guess it can continue to survive. But it's a shame because you're right. What she brings is clarity, sanity, a methodology for living your life, a technique, a method to live a healthy, successful, psychologically healthy, philosophically healthy life. And everybody should discover her. It's a tragedy and a shame that more people don't.
Right. And then to, I guess, kind of switch topics a little bit, I'm curious, what do you think of Scalia's death and the impact? Is this going to be really significant, or will the Republicans be able to block this? And what do you think of Obama not going to the funeral and giving a speech about his death without even wearing a tie? He couldn't even be bothered to dress like a president.
Yeah. I mean, so I'm going to defer on the Scalia question only because next week's show, I'm going to be interviewing Tara Smith, and we're going to discuss Scalia at length. And we're going to discuss Scalia in the context of her new book on judicial review. So, she is the real expert here. And I think that's going to be a fascinating conversation. So I encourage everybody to tune in next week for my discussion with Tara Smith about her book and about Scalia and about what the Republicans should and could do and whether Scalia was a good justice, which I think Tara has a unique perspective on. So I'm gonna wait on that. With regard to Obama, look, does it surprise anybody? And I don't know why he's not going to the funeral. I could be cynical like everybody and say he's not going out of it. It's kind of a disrespect. But I don't know that as a fact. Biden is going, who was much closer to Scalia than Obama ever was, and previous presidents are not always gone to Supreme Court justices' funerals. And now, why he doesn't do the thing in a tie? That's typical Obama. I mean, he doesn't. He's trying to be the casual president. So, I have to say, as somebody who's trying to give more and more talks without a tie, I have mild sympathy, right? I'm trying to break away from the tie. I'm old enough now that I don't have to wear the tie, right? I'm an Israeli. I never wore a tie growing up. I think I bought my first tie at age 30 or something. And I'm trying to get away from ties. And I've been quite successful recently. I don't think I've worn a tie in months. So we will see. Anyway, on the important Scalia question, let's wait for next week. I think you'll really enjoy Tara Smith's comments on it.
Okay.
Cool.
Well, just one more thing I wanted to ask you. As an Israeli, I wonder, you know, most Israelis I talk to tend to think of American culture as rather superficial and kind of front porch friendly. And, you know, especially you live in Southern California, which is very,
yeah.
you know, from my experience, very narcissistic, materialistic. How do you find that, you know, that transition? Because I know a lot of Israelis, they don't really like, you know, that part of America.
Yeah, well, they're being hypocrites. I mean, Israeli culture is basically very much like American culture, just it typically is about 10 years behind in terms of the fads. Israelis are obsessed with American culture, typical Israelis. And Israel has become a very hedonistic culture, a very culture of the moment, of pleasure. And so there is a sense in which they're right, though. So, and I'll give you this experience. When I was growing up, so I grew up in Israel most of the time. I actually lived outside of Israel. I had two stints outside of Israel, one at about age 6 to 8, and then another one from 14 to 16. And when I was 14 to 16, I lived in the U.S. And at that age, there was no question in my mind that Americans were superficial, stupid, ignorant, immature, really childish. I was so much more grown up and sophisticated and knowledgeable. I remember this class in eighth grade, where the teacher, this is like 1975, so this is right after the Vietnam War. And the teacher asked the kids to go to a map and to point out where Vietnam was. There was not a single kid in the class who could do that. I could do it almost blindfold, right? And why would I care about Vietnam, right? I was Israeli. So there's a certain ignorance that Americans have, certainly of the world, and there's certainly a superficiality, particularly among young Americans. Americans don't grow up, sorry, I'm going to insult a bunch of you, but don't grow up until they're about 24, 25. Israelis grow up when they're 16, because you know when you're 16, you're going to the army in a couple of years, and you might die. Particularly in my generation, when Israel fought big wars, you really thought you weren't going to survive this experience. So you had to grow up, and your father went to war. I think I've told this story in the past, but you know, my dad went to two wars. And he went, and I was a little kid, and he was gone. So you grow up very quickly. Now, that's not necessarily a good thing, because you know, growing up fast, you miss out on stuff. So I'm not necessarily saying that's a good thing, but it is true that Americans are, particularly when they're young, superficial, don't know much about the world, and are very, very ignorant in our educational system. Is working to make us more ignorant. Israelis know more about the world. Israelis are more serious than Americans are. But they're also more cynical. Israelis tend to be cynics. I don't know how well you know Israelis, but they're so cynical about everything. because they grew up with a false ideology, socialism, and they rejected all ideology. And they're kind of serious, but they're serious in a dour kind of way rather than a, I mean, what I love, they don't have the American sense of life. They don't have the upbeat, you know, wonderful sense of life that Americans can do attitude that Americans have. They can do, but it's always with a cynical twist to it. Anyway, mm-hmm. Hopefully that answers your question.
No, it did. Thank you. But, I mean, they seem pretty warm, or at least when I go over there. It's very warm.
They're friendly. They're very similar to Americans in that sense. Very friendly, very open. I think they're too friendly. I think the beauty. So this is my explanation for why I left Israel. In Israel, you feel like you have 6 million relatives. Right? Because there's 6 million Jews in Israel. And they, well, maybe more, maybe 8 million now. And they all think that they're your relatives. And they all think that they should poke into your business. And they all think they want to. They should give you advice, and they should know what's going on with you. And they could just knock on your door and walk into your house at any time that they want. All 8 million of them, because they're all Jews and we're all one big happy family, right? So it's that sense, collectivistic, tribal, drives me nuts. Americans are friendly, but if you don't want to be friends with them, they're fine with that. So you could be in a neighborhood and you could be friendly with your neighbors or not friendly with your neighbors, and everybody's cool with that, right? You can be as close to people as you choose to be. In Israel, there's no choice. You're just going to be roped in to all of it. So they're friendly, but a little bit too much, if you understand what I mean.
I hear you. They're definitely, in your business.
Thanks, Dave. Thanks for calling. Thanks for listening.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Yep. All right, let's take another pre-submitted question in there. Oh, we've got a bunch of phone calls. All right, let's do one of these political ones that are more interesting. All right, if free speech is truly damaged by government more so than it is now, then what can one do? Well, you got to fight. No more important an issue than free speech. We got to fight about it. We got to raise it as an issue. The First Amendment is the most important thing that we have to protect. There's nothing more important than that. You got to think when you vote politically who you're voting for. This should be a big factor in how you vote. You cannot vote for people who don't take the First Amendment and free speech seriously. I don't care how much you like other views that they might have. So this becomes a huge issue. You got to make this the primary issue, because when it's lost, the only alternative you have is to pick up that AK-47 and go out there and use force, because once reason is out, force is all that's left. Okay, here's one from Aesthetics. Does rap music have any objective musical qualities? I got two of these questions, hip-hop and rap, and I'm not even sure I know the difference. I'm not qualified to say, because I don't get it. I don't understand rap music. I don't listen to it. I don't see any real musical qualities to it, but you might, and there might be some really good rap, and there might be some not so good rap, and there might be different qualities of rap. I don't know. So I'm going to pass on that one, but I don't enjoy it. I don't like it. I don't think it has any musical qualities, but I'm open to the idea that somebody who's more of an expert in music could find some value. Let me be very clear, though. I don't think it has deep value. Oh, I'm actually pretty sure it doesn't have deep value. So I don't think it has important value. I don't think most popular music has important value. I think most popular music is pretty shallow. I enjoy it. I listen to everything. There's very little music I don't listen to, although I do not listen to rap. I listen to some pop. I listen to country. I listen to jazz. I listen to most form of what you would call. I listen to old popular music. I listen to rock and roll. I listen to, I don't know, all kinds of popular music. Some I think is good. Some I think is not so good. Some I think is mediocre. But in terms of actual deep musical qualities, I think the only real deep musical qualities are to be found in what we call classical music. And that's what if I really want to listen to music, if I want to have an aesthetic experience, it's classical music that I listen to. That's where I think you get the real aesthetic experience. Okay, here's a quick economics question. Is it possible for a corporation to maintain a monopoly to inflate prices by non-coercive means, such as buying out competition or existing in a market requiring high levels of risky investment to enter? Yes, in the short run, but not in the long run. In the long run, competition will arise, even if it's a risky investment to enter, even if it requires a lot of capital to enter. If there are profit opportunities, competitors will come up and beat you down. And they might beat you not in the particular product that you're selling. It might be a product that serves as an alternative to your product. But competition will arise. So in the short run, yes. And what is a short run? You could even say a few years. But in the long run, no. It can't survive. But even if it can survive for a while, for a few years, let's say, there's no justification to break it up. There's no moral, political justification. They're not violating anybody's individual rights. And therefore, the state has no role in monopolies. Okay, let's take one. Oh, this is a kind of an interesting question by somebody who's on the chat. So we'll get a bonus, and then I'm going to go back to the phones. We've got, let's see, one, two, three questions on the phone. Okay, so one of Ayn Rand's three cardinal values reason, purpose, and self-esteem. So purpose is obviously a hugely important value. It is a cardinal value. It is central to the whole ethical theory and to a successful life. One needs purpose in order to live successfully as a value, as something one acts to gain or keep. And he's asking at age 27, it's an area he's still lost. He's still looking for what his purpose in life would be. And then he says, when I think about what gives me the most productive joy, it's reading, writing, and talking to people about political issues and reason. In this sense, one of his biggest heroes is me, right? So he'd like to do the kind of work that I do, okay? But he also has a passion for learning and lecturing. So, like, people's kids. So, like, Elisa Van Dam, who teaches. So it would be teaching, right? And teaching irrational curriculum to kids. But he's a college dropout. And with a two-year-old. So what advice would he give me in terms of following his passion? Should he follow my path or a teacher's path? And how best to achieve such a purpose? So first, I don't see the conflict between the two purposes. I mean, being a teacher doing what I do are very similar. And which one you would prefer is really up to you, and you should try them before you decide. So you know, you should pursue both or either one, but there's no conflict between the two, and they demand very similar skills. You have to learn the topic. You have to know your stuff really, really well, and you have to gain the communication skills, whether it's written communication skills, speaking communication skills, teaching communication skills that would allow you to be successful at either one of those. It's the same, generally the same type of skills. So there's no conflict between the two purposes you're elaborating here. Now the question is how to achieve them, and this is harder. But you got to study. You got to study ideas or study what you want to teach. A degree would be helpful because it's a signal to the marketplace, but it's not necessary. Apply, you know, study, practice. Study, practice, study, practice. Look for opportunities to be employed, whether it's in a school or whether it's at a place like the Institute or another think tank. Develop the skills. And, you know, in the meantime, you might have to do some jobs. That wouldn't be your career. That wouldn't be your purpose. But you'd have to do some jobs in order to sustain yourself while you studied and developed those skills. It's hard, but, you know, I had no idea what I wanted to do at 27. I had no idea. I've had four purposes or four careers, four, five, or six, I don't know, lots of them. And I didn't land up in this job and know that this is what I wanted until I was basically 30. I was 39, right? 39. So, you know, I was in the Army, which was not chosen, so that doesn't really count. I was a student. I was an engineer. I thought that's what I wanted to do in life. And then I was a student again. I almost became a professional student, which is what it takes to get an MBA and then a PhD. And then I was a professor, but for a while I wanted to be in business. But then I switched and became a professor, and then I'm doing this. And while I was a professor, and to this day, I have businesses on the side which serve as kind of mini purposes. So life is long. There are lots of things that you can do. Make sure you're enjoying what you're doing, and make sure you're constantly developing yourself so that you can improve yourself, so that you can take on a more challenging purpose as you age, and that you will be more and more successful. So, you know, hopefully that answers your question. If not, you know, you can call in. By the way, anybody who's just joined the show, you can call in with a question about pretty much anything. I don't promise to answer everything, but you can call in. I'm taking written questions. I'm taking questions over the phone. 347-324-3075. As it turns out, it looks like I'm not going to get through a lot of these questions, so we'll leave them for a future question show, Q&A show. Hopefully you guys are having fun. You'll let me know. Partially we'll see how many people listen to the show. But, you know, help promote the show. I really would appreciate it if you use social media, all types of social media, LinkedIn, Twitter, Facebook, and others, to pitch the show. And if you particularly like the Q&A show, then help me really pitch it so that I have an incentive to do it again. Do you know what show? Here's a question for you guys. I wonder if you guys know what show was listened to most of all the shows that I've done over the last year and a month and a half. What show has been listened to most of all the shows that I've done? I'll tell you in a minute. It's kind of curious, and I don't know why, but it has, by a lot, not even by a little. Like, it's more than double any other show that I've done. This show is more than double any other show that I've done. So I'm taking guesses for which show that is, and I'll answer after this call that we're going to get. But let me emphasize this. If you want these shows to continue, and if you like a particular show, let the world know and get people to listen. This show should be listened to by 100,000 people. We're far, far, far from that. All right. Hi, you're on the Yvonne Brooks Show. Who's this? 415 area code. Who's this? Hello, I can hear you breathe. You're on the Yvonne Brooks Show. Who's this? All right, he's not answering, so we'll try him again in a little while. It's area code 415. We'll get back to you in a little while. Okay, this one, I don't have an area code because it must be from overseas or something. Hi, you're on the Yvonne Brooks Show.
Hi, Yaron, it's Jonathan.
Hey, Jonathan, how's it going?
Oh, here's my guess. Your most listened to show was your show about everyone's favorite Christmas movie.
No, it wasn't. I would that show didn't do that well. The show about charity and about It's a Wonderful Life didn't do that well. I was surprised.
That's actually my question, and I'll make it really brief. It's about aesthetics, which I think I only started even understanding even in a little bit from an objectivist perspective after a number of years. Ayn Rand always talked about what she called tiddlywink music, which I understand was kind of popular music of the day, and I know I have had that experience of waving a baton to music that really inspired you. My question is, what is your Yaron Brooks tiddlywink music, and what type of music today do you think in contemporary culture would Ayn Rand consider to be her brand of tiddlywink music, if there was? Would it be pop? You know, what would be today's incarnation of tiddly music, and what is it for you? And thanks for the show.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So, you know, what is it for me? I think it's the kind of the pop rock music I grew up with, and I think this is something that's interesting about popular music. Popular music is, I think, associative music. It's an appeal to a sense of life, but it also appeals to particular memories, particular things that were happening. So I don't think it's deep. It doesn't really go to the core of one's emotional values. I'd say this is particularly true of the last 50 years of popular music. So to me, it's the music of the 70s, all kinds of music from the 70s, because I just get up and, you know, it reminds me of growing up. It connects to something deep inside about the emotions of the time.
I remember a lot of music in the 70s. Can we just get a few song titles or artists? I don't want to belabor you, but give us a few songs.
I don't know. What would it be? Names are so... I'm so bad with stuff like names. People in the chat are saying Rush, Rush, Rush. I never liked Rush. I never got into Rush. I never understood why people like Rush other than the connection Ayn Rand. Sorry. That no evaluation meant there, but everybody wants Rush. No, it would be anything from, from the Beatles, which is really 60s, who I loved. I loved the Beatles, to Bob Dylan, to Pink Floyd. So the whole range of music that from really just popular stuff to, you know, maybe darker and which is not very tiddlywink like Pink Floyd. But anything from that era just evokes a certain emotion in me that's pretty positive. Elton John, Billy Joel, but even some of the leftist folk singers like Bob Dylan, who I can still listen to and kind of really get. I used to, when I was in high school, when I'd get into my dark moods, a big part of it would be, you know, how does it feel like to be like a Rolling Stone? You know, music like that, you know, gets me connected back to that period for better or for worse. Simon and Garfunkel, and I definitely like Paul Simon, definitely used to. So those are the kind, that's the kind of music that does it for me. But I consider that kind of light music, not very serious music. My favorite music, the music that I get up to and conduct and get charged up about and jump up and down about, is classical music. I love Beethoven, and I know Ayn Rand didn't, but the drama, the passion, the clash of wills that is expressed in Beethoven, I just love that conflict and that drama. I love the romanticism of Rachmaninoff and Tchaikovsky and Brahms and Schubert. I love Schubert and so on. What would Ayn Rand think? I think she wouldn't like anything today. I really do. I think she would condemn it all. I really think that today's music is so far removed from her. She would be horrified by my love of 70s music because her sense of life was so light and positive, and the tiddlywink music is so. And I like the tiddlywink music, the operetta kind of stuff. Frank, the kind of music that you had in the 20s and 30s, but even in the 40s and 50s with Frank Sinatra, it's just so much more melodic and friendly and positive. So I think Frank Sinatra is probably as far as she would go. I think anything starting with rock and roll, she would be against. That's just my sense from her. And certainly rap, she would have condemned rap to hell. I mean, she really would have. A death metal, all of that, she would have condemned to hell, right? So I can't think of a music that she would say was her type of music, her sense of life type of music. Sorry, Jonathan. I wish there was something.
Thanks, Yaron.
All right, let's take another phone question so we make sure I get all the phone calls before we wrap up. Hi, you're listening to Yaron Brooks Show. Who's this?
Good afternoon. This is Skyler calling from Newark, Dr. Brooks.
Hey, Skyler. How's it going?
Well, a little bit warmer than usual. It's about 55 degrees over here.
Can't beat Southern California in the winter.
I guess
Phoenix can. Phoenix can.
Yeah, that's about right. My question pertains to a little bit personal sure. Regarding your sons. Did you come in with the idea of not introducing them to Ayn Rand? Did you introduce them to Ayn Rand at a certain age? And also, is your wife an objectivist? If that's too personal, you don't have to answer.
Okay. My wife is definitely an objectivist. I don't know how I she's definitely an objectivist. On our first date, I was a pretty dumb objectivist in those days. On my first date, I gave her a copy of The Fountainhead, and she loved it. And we bonded over – actually, I think my first date – I took her to a lecture, if you can believe that, by some Israeli objectivist. This is a long, long time ago, 1982. So she's definitely an objectivist and has been you know, in that sense, a soulmate. Well, in all senses, a soulmate of mine. But I couldn't imagine, particularly given the work that I do, living with somebody who didn't appreciate the work that I did and who didn't agree with the ideas that I'm advocating. My sons, I mean, my view of raising kids is you got to raise them rationally. You got to do the best job that you can. You got to engage with the best ideas possible about raising children. And I did the best job, I hope, that I could, you know, to do that. But I definitely was going to – they were introduced to objectivism through dinner conversation. You know, we got a dinner with Leonard Peikoff, and my little kids would hear his rants. So that, you know, you couldn't avoid the objectivism. They would be in the car when I would do radio interviews after 9/11, which is probably not the healthiest thing I could imagine for kids. So I don't know that I would recommend that. Listen to me go on about foreign policy when they're little. So they were probably overexposed when they were very young. And then I didn't encourage them to read the books, but they read them in school because they went to a school run by an objectivist. They went to the Van Damme Academy in those days. And they read Anthem and I think The Fountainhead ultimately in school. And then they read Atlas Shrugged by themselves. So, you know, I was going to introduce them to Atlas Shrugged, but at an appropriate age. I wasn't one of these read them Atlas Shrugged when they're 6 years old. You know, this is something you have to do in the late teens.
Absolutely.
All right, that's about as personal as I'm willing to be.
All right, thank you, Dr. Brooke. Appreciate it.
Sure, anytime. Thanks, Carla. All right, one more call here. Hi, you're on Brooke Show? No, we got two more calls. Who's this?
Aloha, it's Stuart.
Hey, Stuart, how's it going?
Okay, so, you know, Hawaii is a military state. We have Pearl Harbor, so I wanted to ask you about the military.
Sure.
So, you know, I've read about how, you know, a proper function of government is the military. And during the whole Iraq war, I heard people getting very angry about the military hiring these private military firms like Blackwater, you know, and Blackwater got in trouble, you know, for shooting at these people. So I want to ask you, in a purely capitalist society where, you know, the government is limited to its proper functions, is it possible the military would still outsource to these private military firms like Blackwater?
I don't think so. I don't think it would outsource the key, the use of force. So it might outsource things like logistics, trucks and food and things like that. But I do not believe it would outsource the military. The military is a government function. And when you outsource it, you create all kinds of problems. Are these people acting as agents of the government? Are they acting as their own agents? Do they act as a part of the government 8 hours of the day? What happens the rest of the time? When you join the military, it's a very specific, very rigorous, very clear contract that you sign with the military. You work 24/7 for the time, for the length of your contract. There is no time off, in a sense. You're part of the military. So I do not think I think the use in Iraq was a cop-out for their inability to do what they needed to do. It was a cop-out for not being willing to call on the American people to volunteer for the army because they knew people wouldn't volunteer for the army because it was a bad war fought badly and nobody would send their kids to fight in a bad war fought badly. And this is one of the checks on government, right? One of the checks on government is if you have an all-volunteer army and you can't raise enough volunteers to go to war, that's a sign you shouldn't go to war. Right. So,
right.
So I believe it should be completely government.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, may I ask you about terminology?
Sure.
Because when I'm talking, especially with libertarians, they say, you know, often these leftists will say the government gives these favors to big businesses, and then the libertarian responds, no, you're not thinking of capitalism. That's corporatism. And I don't think corporatism is a good word for this cronyistic relationship because I think it assumes that corporations are to blame for government, you know,
but it's more than that. If you
money.
Understand the libertarians, many of the libertarians are anti-corporations. And I did a course years ago about the corporation. But they object to corporations in principle. And as such, corporatism is a horrible word because it's exactly trying to do that. It's trying to paint the corporation as inherently evil, as inherently bad. And I would reject that completely. I would call it cronyism. I think it's cronyism. But really, it's just statism. All statism is cronyism. There is no statism that is not cronyism.
Right.
And that's why it's not capitalism. Capitalism is the opposite of cronyism. It's the opposite of capitalism. It, never call it crony capitalism. It's always just either just cronyism or just statism. All right,
right.
Stuart, I'm going to take one more call over the phone.
Hello.
And then, oops, sorry, I cut you off there. Hi, you're on the Iran Book Show. Who's this? Oh, I can't hear you. Hello? 210 area code. You're on the Iran Book Show. Who's this?
Hello?
Hello, yes. Who's this?
Yes, let me turn this other one down then. Hi,
okay.
My name is Kathleen. I'm in from San Antonio, and I have a question about the FBI and Edward Snowden. I don't mean Edward Snowden. I was just like reading it.
You mean Apple?
About the FBI, court order to bypass the security for Apple to bypass the security, and what your thoughts were on that?
Yeah. Okay. So I am going to defer on this only because I do another radio show. Live in Chicago in about an hour and 20 minutes. And that's going to be the theme of my show. It's just going to be on Apple and this issue with the FBI. So I encourage you to listen to that. You can listen to it live at, let's see, you're in San Antonio. So it'll be at 4 o'clock your time. And it'll be on.
So I will definitely be listening to that. Can I ask one more question?
Sure, although it's not on Blog Talk Radio. It'll be posted on Blog Talk Radio later in the week. That one's on iHeartRadio.
Oh, it's on iHeartRadio.
You go to iHeartRadio and you type in AM560 Chicago,
okay,
or AM560 The Answer, and at 2 o'clock I'm on that.
And this is at 2 p.m. when?
2 p.m. your time, 2 p.m. Texas time.
All righty, but not today, is it?
It's today.
Today.
It's today. And then it'll be up on Blog Talk in a few days.
Okay.
But it's on iHeartRadio AM560 Chicago.
iHeartRadio AM560. Okay, I'm going to look that up. My other question is about a political question about, like, if Donald Trump gets the nomination or even the presidency, I was just wondering what kind of effect that will have on us trying to return this country to the values of individualism and capitalism. Will that, you know, hurt us in the long run? I know you talked a lot about Donald Trump last week, but could you elaborate a little bit on that?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think it hurts us in the long run. I think it takes us backwards. Donald Trump, because he will be perceived as a right-wing candidate, and he will cut deals left and right. He will move the country to the left on most issues, and on some issues, you know, which are the least important ones, he will move us to the right. He will cut deals with the religious right. He will cut deals with our enemies. He's friendly to Putin. He will make it very difficult for a proper good candidate in the future to run, because I think the one appealing factor he has is he's not politically correct. So we want that in a candidate, but if everybody in the future associated not being politically correct with kind of a Donald Trump flakiness, that is bad. He's also a statist. I mean, as you'll hear, I side with Apple on the FBI versus Apple issue, and Donald Trump clearly sides on the FBI on the statist side of it. And I think generally he is a statist. He's not an individualist, so it's going to be hard. Okay.
All right, perfect. Thank you.
Sure. All right, so I think we're done with the phone questions. But you can still call in 347-324-3075. Okay, let's get to, let's do some sex questions. Are there any ethical problems with the creation of sex robots? That's a good question, right? Are there any ethical problems with the creation of sex robots? So first, I don't see what the problem is. What the ethical problem of creating the sex robots is? I mean, it's you're creating a value for somebody, so then, is there an ethical problem with using a sex robot? I can't see what it is. Right? A sex robot is just another form of masturbation. Using a sex robot, if you get your kicks off of it, go for it. And so as long as you're not trying to evade and pretend that the sex robot is a human being in some unhealthy psychological way, I have no problem with sex toys. Now we're really getting no problem in terms of ethics, in terms of practicality. Generally, I think another human being is much, much better. Much, much better. So I'm all for having sex with human beings. But I don't have an ethical problem with somebody who doesn't have a human being to have sex with using a toy. Okay, so this leads to this next question. Generally, I'm pro-sex, as you'll discover in a minute. Can you be a consistent objectivist and have sex with a variety of different people? Now, this one's an interesting one. A variety of different people. Objectivism doesn't say anything about how many people you can have sex with, sequentially or at any given point in time. So, well, I mean, generally, our view of sex is it's one-on-one because of the profound nature of sex and that it, you know, doing it with more than one person at a time, you just can't get what you need and what sex has the potential to offer you from doing it with more one person at one time. But objectivism does not hold that you have one person out there that is a match for you, and that is the only person you can ever have sex with. You know, as long as you're taking the sex seriously, as long as you share values, some values at some level with this other person, as long as you, you know, like this person in some significant way, then I think, you know, there's nothing about objectivism that says you can't have sex with more than one partner. Think about Dagny in Atlas Shrugged. She has sex with three of the heroes. I mean, cool. You know, lucky for her and lucky for them. If it's you meet people who you admire and love, or and you have sex with them, and then you fall out of love with them, you can fall in love again and have sex with somebody else. And variety, I'm not sure what variety means in this context. Every person is different, so in that sense, just by the fact that they're different, it's variety. You know, you don't want to be promiscuous. That's what objectivism says. You just don't have sex randomly with people. You don't have sex as a means for gaining self-esteem. You don't have sex superficially. Sex should be taken seriously. Or take Dominique in the Fountainhead. How many people I can't even remember how many people she has sex with. And some of them are not the heroes, right? For other reasons. She's trying to self-destruct. But the point is that sex, if you take it seriously, and if it's viewed from the perspective of an incredible sharing of an incredible value with another human being, there might be several over a lifetime human beings. There might be a variety of different human beings over a lifetime that you would have sex with because they are worthy of sharing that. And again, you might be mistaken about whether the person is worthy. And you might discover that, but life is to be lived, and sex is part of life. And I'm very pro-sex. I do not believe in waiting endlessly to find the right person. Experimentation in sex is good, and part of that experimentation is having more than one partner over a lifetime. Now, if you meet the person that you land up falling madly in love with, when you're very young and you land up, that's your only sexual partner, that's fine. But don't hang around, not have sex, waiting for that one up. All right. All right. We've got two quick phone calls. Let's try to do those. And then I've got a bunch of written questions that we could go on forever. So we'll have to devote another show for the rest of the written questions. Hi, you're on the Yaron Brook Show. Who's this?
Hi, is this, am I on 847?
Yes, you are, 847.
Oh, hi, my name is Tejo from Chicago suburbs.
Hey, Tejo.
Well, how much time do I have to talk?
Do it quick.
Well, first of all, I did pre-order your books,
and I
already read Free Market Revolution. And I do want to say that you have had a profound influence on my life. I ended up dropping out of grad school because of you, and that's a good thing because you saved me a lot of time and money.
Okay, good. Thanks.
I can tell you the story later, but I guess my question is, what is the moral way to survive in a society that is premised on coercion? I mean, it seems like the only practical way to become is to become part of the coercion system. Like, if you're a student who qualifies for MAP grants, you know, welfare subsidies for college, then you're kind of forced to accept the welfare, because if you don't accept the welfare, your competitors, you know, other students with the same career goals, they will accept their MAP grants, and they'll use that to gain a competitive advantage over you, and then they'll take the job that you would have otherwise had in a non-welfare state. And I guess similarly, a corporation that doesn't accept subsidies will be at a disadvantage to competitors who do, and thus a corporation is then sort of forced to lobby for those subsidies as well. And
yep.
I guess the heart of my question is, you know, the one thing that I could never get around my head about objectivism is that it always seems like the moral and the practical are opposites. And I know Ayn Rand says otherwise, but I just can't wrap my head around that.
Well, I mean, unfortunately, in an irrational culture, the moral and the practical can be opposites, in the sense that you could get penalized for being a good person, for being a just person, for doing the right thing. And that's what makes, more than anything else, that is what makes statism in all its forms so unjust. It's that it penalizes you as an individual when you might be doing right, when you might be doing good. So when Ayn Rand says the moral is the practical, what she means is, when you're free, you know, when you live in a proper society, and sometimes you're going to have to give up on the best alternative because it's not the best alternative in this context, in the context of coercion. And it makes thinking and it makes reason so much more, so much harder. And again, this is what is so evil about the world in which we live and about the statism which we live under. So yes, you have to, in a sense, participate. But let me say this. I mean, Ayn Rand wrote an essay, and I highly, highly recommend it, on is it okay to accept a scholarship as an objectivist? So look it up. I'm pretty sure it's in The Virtue of Selfishness and Capitalism, Not Known Ideal.
Okay.
It's an okay, so look it up. And she says, absolutely, it's okay to accept a scholarship. This is the system they have created. Don't put yourself at a disadvantage. And look, if you're going to be a productive person, you're going to pay plenty of taxes that are going to return that money. You, as the advocate against these scholarships, you, as the advocate against subsidies, you, as the advocate against Social Security, against Medicare, are the only legitimate recipient of it, because you're advocating against it and because it is being used as a tool against you. But you cannot place your life at a disadvantage because you're trying to be moral. That would be crazy, because the standard of morality is life. So you can't place yourself at a massive disadvantage by being moral, so-called moral, right? So it's completely moral to take the student loan. Now, there's in business, it's tricky. It's tricky. So you have to make sure that by getting the subsidies, you're not getting an added advantage. You can't, you need to speak up against the subsidy while you're getting it. Just like when you get the student loan, you still got to speak up against student loans on principle. when you get this, if a business says, I'm taking this subsidy because I have no choice, my competitors are taking the subsidy, but I'm against all subsidy. Take John Allison, who was the CEO of BB&T. He got massive subsidies from the government. He also was massively regulated by the government. But he took TARP. He got deposit insurance, which is a subsidy. But he fought against them. He fought against them on principle. And that's what made it moral for him to accept them. Does that make sense?
Okay.
Read the essay.
Yeah, that's reassuring, and I will read the essay. It's just that...
And Ankur Gatte on our website has an op-ed about this as well, has an article about this. So look up Ankur Gatte, G-H-A-T-E, about this. But read Ayn Rand's essay, because this is an important point. Don't feel like you, because you're an objectivist, are therefore at a disadvantage. No, you're at an advantage in society because you know that your life is the standard.
Okay, but doesn't all this imply that we could never get out of this coercive society? Because if all the most productive people in the world are also, you know, forced to be part of that system.
Yeah, but if the most productive people of the world speak up against it, then we will win. Then we will win. I mean, that's what
okay,
it's going to take.
Thank you, Dr. Brooke.
It's going to take the great businessmen of our time to speak up against it, and that's what will change everything. Thank you. Really good question. And please don't – objectivists should never feel like a competitive disadvantage in life. It's an advantage in life. I shouldn't use competitive because life is not about competition. It's an advantage in life. And if it's clunking against reality, check your premises. That was Ayn Rand's thing. And here she wrote a brilliant essay on exactly this topic. Okay, I'm going to take two very quick calls. All right, you're on the Yaron Brooks Show. Quickly. Quick question.
Hey, Yaron, wow. So much to say. Thanks for having me on the show. I think that we should probably take some of Ayn Rand's principles, especially the idea of looking after yourself, because you can only help so many people, and apply that to communities and, you know, try and get Ayn Rand's concepts onto the blockchain, because you know, there's technologies coming out in the fintech space that could revolutionize you know, the world, but it needs to have the right principles behind it to be able to change society. And I thank you for also speaking about the
sure.
The stuff that you were speaking about before on relationships.
Thanks.
I only caught it like sort of on the tail end, but it was a really good good conversation.
Appreciate it. Well, thanks for calling. And look, absolutely, I'll leave it up to you guys to apply objectivism to the blockchain. But you did say something that I want to correct. It's not the case that you're supposed to help yourself so that you can help more people. The standard of ethics is your life. You're supposed to help yourself as an end in itself. And then if you want to help other people, fine. If it's in your self-interest, if it's part of what it means to help yourself. But you're not helping yourself. It's not like that airplane thing. Put on your mask first so you can help your neighbor put on their mask. No, put on your mask because your life is the most important thing that you have. And then there's no harm in, there's a lot of good in helping your neighbor. But that's not why you're putting on the mask. All right. Last question, 302 area code.
Yes, Skyler calling from Delaware again.
Okay, you've got to do it really quick.
Really quick. Is the Ayn Rand Institute ever going to have a fiction writing essay, fiction writing contest?
Right, great question.
Like
got
that
it.
Short writing?
Great Thanks. Question. Thanks, Skyler. Probably not, because the standards by which they evaluate fiction writing are aesthetic standards. Fiction is not primarily a means of conveying ideas. It's primarily a means of expressing metaphysical value judgments. And therefore, you could write a great essay that is not consistent with the ideas of objectivism. And you can write a great short story. And you could write a lousy, horrible short story, as many people do, which is consistent with the ideas of objectivism. And the standard to evaluate a short story is, so if somebody wants to start a romanticism institute that supports and promotes romanticism in the culture, I'm right there with you. I would love to see that. And that's where you would promote and do essay contests in romantic literature. But the standard wouldn't be philosophical correctness. it would be whether it was romantic or not, whether it was good or not. All right. So thanks, everybody. I had fun. Hopefully you had fun. If you had fun, help promote the show. Get the word out there. You notice we took no commercial breaks because I was on a roll. We could do this again soon because I've got lots of questions. But the way in which I will know that you liked this concept and this show is by how much you promote it, not just today, not just tomorrow, but for the whole week. I measure the amount of listenership to this show on a weekly kind of chunks. So go out there, promote the hell out of this, get your friends to listen to it. Let's get the numbers up, and I will do another Q&A show really soon. Thank you all for listening. I've got tons and tons of questions still to do about everything. I skipped a lot of the political questions because I do politics all the time. But we got stuff about Iron Man. We got personal questions about history, about AOI, about more about immigration. I definitely have to do the immigration ones because I meant to do them today and I forgot. So those of you submitted immigration questions, I'll be doing them in the future about your Muslim immigration. All of that will be done. I'm not trying to avoid you guys. Next Q&A show or next show that is not about Justice Scalia, which is what the next show is going to be about with Tara Smith. So don't miss next week's show, same time, same place. See you next week.
For what is a man? What has he got? If not himself, then he